I think that what is happening among the Israelis that I speak with is that their heartbreak is competing with their rage. And their rage itself is divided. First of all, against Hamas, the people who perpetrated what has to be called the most barbaric atrocity imaginable. But there's a second form of rage not far behind, which is the rage that Israelis feel at their own government.
That's New York Times columnist Brett Stevens explaining Israeli reactions to the terrorist attack that shocked the world.
So there are going to be two reckonings coming Israel's way, one against the enemies who hit them and the other against the politicians who failed them.
I'm Margaret Hoover. This is the Firing Line podcast. Israelis awoke Saturday to a devastating multi-pronged attack by the terrorist group Hamas, launching rockets, storming towns, and slaughtering civilians, including children and babies.
The savage attacks that Hamas perpetrated against innocent Israelis are mind-boggling.
The violence left at least 1,200 people dead, with more than 150 still held hostage.
Israel's a small country. It has just over 9 million people. Every single person in Israel knows, is close to, is related to someone who is dead or someone who's being held hostage in Gaza.
And it has spurred an Israeli siege on Gaza.
The entire discourse in Israel is centered on one thing, which is how we eradicate Hamas. Now, how they do it tactically, whether they can do it by minimizing civilian casualties, I hope so.
Brett Stevens is a conservative columnist at the New York Times and former editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post. We talked about whether Iran was directly involved.
I don't believe Iran for a second in saying they had no hand in planning this. It was far too convenient for them.
And President Biden's pledge of unwavering support for Israel.
We must be crystal clear. We stand with Israel. And we will make sure Israel has what it needs to take care of its citizens, defend itself, and respond to this attack.
I am grateful that there is moral clarity in the White House. It is a resource that is in short supply in Washington these days.
But Stevens says others on the left have had a much more disturbing response.
You went to Midtown Manhattan to observe a pro-Palestinian rally. What'd you see?
I saw euphoria.
Brett Stevens, welcome to Firing Line.
Thank you for having me.
Hamas's attack resulted in the deadliest day for Jews since the Holocaust. We are still learning about the horrors that Israelis endured. More than 100 people were murdered in one kibbutz, children and grandparents taken away as hostages. There are reports that entire families were shot in their homes and babies found murdered. How are you processing the horrors?
You know, I lived in Israel a number of years. I have extended family there. My closest friends are Israelis. And when events like this happen, imagine if all your family had been living in Lower Manhattan on September 11th. It's a similar feeling. You call, you write. One friend of mine, very close, her brother-in-law was in a kibbutz, hard on the Gaza border. They were trapped in their safe room at home, and the army wasn't coming to their rescue. And ultimately, they were rescued by the father of the brother-in-law who was trapped with his family, a retired general, 62-year-old Noam Tibon, who came to the rescue of his son, Amir. I think a good way for Americans to understand what happened on Saturday is to do a little math. Israel's a small country. It has just over 9 million people. So for every Israeli, there are 35 Americans. That's the difference in the size of the countries. So when 1,200 Israelis, that's the number that I have now, it's surely going up as more bodies are found. When 1,200 Israelis are killed in a single day, 1,200 times 35, I think just off the top of my head, that's over 40,000. So you have to imagine that as 13 9/11s happening on the same day. It means that the degrees of separation between victims and people who are close to them are very small. I would wager to everyone watching this who remembers 9/11, I would wager very few people actually knew someone who died on 9/11. They watched it, but very few people actually knew a victim. Every single person in Israel knows, is close to, is related to someone who is dead or someone who's being held hostage in Gaza.
What insights can you share with us from your Israeli contacts?
You know, there's a saying in Israel that Israel is strong, and Israel does not feel strong right now. I think that what is happening among the Israelis that I speak with is that their heartbreak is competing with their rage. Mm. And their rage itself is divided. First of all, against Hamas, the people who perpetrated what has to be called the most barbaric atrocity imaginable. This wasn't a plane just going into a building. This was face-to-face, hand-to-hand. Every single one of these atrocities was a one-on-one transaction. And the depth of Israel's rage, I don't think can be underestimated. That's why so many calls at the moment for Israeli restraint seem really misplaced and misjudged. But there's a second form of rage not far behind, which is the rage that Israelis feel at their own government. This happened not in a vacuum. This happened after nearly a year in which Israel had been bitterly divided by legislation that hardly anyone asked for. You know, if you go back a year to the last electoral contest, I followed it very closely. No one was talking about judicial reform. They were talking about the economy. They were talking about internal security. They were talking about the threats from Iran. And instead, this country was needlessly divided in a way that materially hampered their readiness. And there are report after report from current and former Israeli military leaders saying our readiness is suffering. So when an attack of this nature occurred and the response from the military and internal security forces was so dilatory, so slow, there's a reason for it. So there are going to be two reckonings coming Israel's way, one against the enemies who hit them and the other against the politicians who failed them.
You've been critical of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his current government for anti-democratic measures, including, as you mentioned, the efforts to weaken the judicial system. Those changes to the judiciary, as you mentioned, have been deeply divisive and caused months of protests, including reservists threatening to refuse to serve. Are you saying that responsibility for this attack lies in part with Benjamin Netanyahu and the political division he's sowed over the last year?
Look, I want to be clear. The full weight of moral responsibility lies with Hamas and an attack that was wholly unprovoked and historic in its barbarity. But Israel is a country with a very small margins for error. And when you're prime minister of Israel, you've got one job, which is to safeguard the lives of the Israeli people. I remember a few years ago, during one of his many campaigns for office, Netanyahu, whose nickname is Bibi, did this kind of funny, sweet ad in which this couple is trying to get ready to go out, and they're waiting for the babysitter, and there's a knock on the door, and it's Bibi Netanyahu. And he said, "You asked for the babysitter." And the joke was, "I'm Mr. Security. I'm the guy you can rely on to keep you safe at home." And what happened was, in the last year, on account of his legal travails, because there are criminal indictments against the prime minister, and his very narrow majority in government, which forced him into a coalition with extreme right-wing parties, and his pursuit of a judicial reform bill that nobody asked for, he hopelessly divided a country whose greatest strength has always been a kind of a fundamental unity, a sense that they're alone in a boat and they sink or swim or float together. That was, in my view, unforgivable governance. And people had been saying this loud and clear for over a year. So my sense is Israel, because it's in crisis, is going to give the prime minister and now an emergency cabinet, including his opposition leaders, time and space to hopefully reach a result, an unequivocal result in the battle with Hamas and its allies, which include Iran and Hezbollah. And after that, I cannot see him surviving. He does not deserve to survive politically as prime minister.
It's worth pointing out that Israel has a strong history of inquiries and mm-hmm. accountability for previous prime ministers, like the Arag-Nat Commission, which investigated the perhaps circumstances leading up to the Yom Kippur War yeah. and ultimately led to the end of Golda Meir's prime ministership. Do you expect that events similar to those previous inquiries will play out?
Unquestionably. Israel has a long tradition of this, not just after the 73 war, but after the invasion of Lebanon. It's actually one of the great strengths of the country. It's why it tends to outperform, which is to say they look and investigate and think about their failures at least as hard as they think about their successes. It's very hard to see how his government or anyone in his government, including the defense minister, is going to be able to survive with their reputations intact.
Not even 10 days before Hamas's attack, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said, quote, "The Middle East region is quieter today than it has been in two decades." Mm-hmm. The attacks eluded not just Israeli intelligence, but U.S. intelligence as well.
Well, American intelligence failures are less surprising because there's a longer history for them. But in Jake's partial defense, there was a sense before this attack that the real battle lines in the Middle East were really where with Iran in the Gulf, mm-hmm. further to the east. One of the problems here, and a lot of people shared in this misconception, was the idea that Hamas, as dangerous as it was a containable threat, because being in the Gaza Strip, having its forces periodically kind of mowed down by its conflicts with Israel, it was a sort of a nuisance threat in the spectrum of the threats that confronted Israel. And that concept was fundamentally mistaken. You know, before 1973, Israel also had what was called the concept. There was a word in Hebrew for it, concepcia, the paradigm, I think is probably the better English translation for it. And that was the idea that Egypt was not going to attack because Egypt couldn't possibly defeat Israel. And since they didn't want to get defeated, they weren't going to attack. And the Egyptians, I think, understood that that was the Israeli thinking. What Israel didn't imagine is that Egypt's aims might be more limited or might be different from its aims in the previous war, which was the conquest of Israel. Its aims at the time were just a successful crossing of the canal. And that failure flummoxed, flabbergasted, and kind of broke to some extent, Israel's back. It certainly broke the leadership. And something similar happened this time around. There was this concept that Hamas, dangerous as it was there in Gaza, surrounded by walls, surrounded by cameras, surrounded by aerial surveillance. The worst they could do was fire rockets that could be intercepted by the Iron Dome system. A point I make tangentially is what happened here is a demonstration of the danger when you substitute technological solutions for strategic thinking. Mm. because the Israelis said, well, we've got Iron Dome, and we have this thing that detects tunnels or stops tunneling underground, and we have all of these cameras, so the technology solves our problem. But when you think that technology solves your problem, it is an invitation to an opponent to use asymmetric means to defeat your seeming technological advantages by playing by wholly different rules. And that's what seems to have happened here.
You have said that Hamas's goals in this attack go beyond terrorizing and killing Israelis. What is the larger strategic goal?
Well, first of all, for Hamas, killing Israelis is not just incidental.
It's an end in of itself.
It's what they do. This is, if you will, a values-driven organization, the worst values imaginable, but the value is kill Jews with the aim of eradicating the state of Israel and the Jews inside of it. But I think there were other aims. One was the sheer shock, the ability to destroy the kind of placid Israeli idea that they had now become the startup nation. They were launching into a new Middle East with peace deals with various Arab neighbors and partners. They had become too big to really worry about the Palestinians. That was one goal. The second goal, I think much more significant, was to incur such a massive Israeli response, which we may or may not get, that it would destroy the hopes of a peace agreement, the burgeoning hopes of a peace agreement between Israel and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
And this is, by the way, going to be very interesting to watch, very interesting for Israel to think about how it responds, because one thing about the kingdom is what it says in public isn't necessarily what it thinks in private. I don't think the kingdom is necessarily looking at Israel and praying for its restraint, even though that is what its public utterances suggest.
Netanyahu has vowed to eradicate Hamas. In your view, is this the right objective?
Yes, let me caveat that a little bit. I interviewed him in 2009, right after the first major war between Hamas-controlled Gaza and Israel. And at the time, Ehud Olmert, his predecessor, was prime minister, and he went straight at Olmert saying, you know, this operation is a failure. The goal, the optimal goal is to, at a minimum, or should be to eradicate Hamas, but at a minimum, cut off their supply of weapons that are coming through tunnels under Gaza's border with Egypt. So he said that to me. I have it on record. And 14 years later, more than 14 years later, the status quo obtained. So what Bibi says and what Bibi does tend to be very different things. He is a much more cautious strategist and tactician than his rhetoric typically suggests. This time, however, I think it's different because the entire discourse in Israel is centered on one thing, which is how we eradicate Hamas. Now, how they do it tactically, whether they can do it by minimizing civilian casualties, I hope so, by not starving Palestinians to death or cutting them off from water and electricity, I hope so. But that goal that Hamas must not be allowed to remain in power, I think, is one that no prime minister in Israel can get away from.
But this isn't just to keep them from having power. This is eradicating them. So Israeli troops and tanks are on the border of Gaza. It appears as though a ground invasion is coming. What does eradicating Hamas look like? Is it house-to-house fighting?
That's going to be very difficult for the Israelis. The Gazans know their back streets. I've been to Gaza numerous times. It's not like broad avenues and parkways.
Yeah.
It's dense, worn of people, threats, tunnels underground. That being said, it is not mission impossible from a military standpoint. I mean, the Gaza Strip is about the size of, I'm guessing, Manhattan.
Okay.
With fewer people, a beach to one side, so no avenue for strategic retreat. The Israelis have been studying it for decades. They possessed it for a long period of time. Now, what does eradicate Hamas mean? First of all, it means taking Hamas out of power in a way that they cannot return to power. So a conclusion in which Hamas kind of comes right back out like a jack in the box and says, you know, we're here. That's not going to happen. Secondly, eradicating Hamas probably means eradicating their leadership, killing them, capturing them, whatever, you know, this is going to be a war. And I can't see anyone in the Hamas leadership surviving this particular battle. There are lots of Hamas fighters, about 10,000, 20,000 people. We don't really know for sure. A lot of those guys are going to be in pitched battles, and it's very unlikely that they are going to survive. But there's a fourth layer, which is eradicating Hamas as an idea. And Hamas is the Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. It subscribes to a particular ideology. And that is not eradicated. That might dissipate over generations, but I don't see that going away, you know, tomorrow, next year, a decade from now.
The UK says that it supports, quote, proportional response.
Yeah.
I know you've criticized this idea, saying that it sounds morally reasonable, but it emboldens adversaries and, quote, guarantees future conflicts.
So there are, I think, a variety of definitions of proportionality, but often the idea comes down to something quite simple. If 1,200 Israelis are dead, then roughly 1,200 Palestinians should be dead, and you get a proportional response. You need a response that is proportional to achieving an objective, and in this case, the objective is eradicating Hamas, or at least dethroning it, getting defeating its fighters, making it incapable to be a political or military force. But the logic of proportionality, even though there's something quite inviting about it, right? I mean, we want to be proportional, especially when in matters of life and death, doesn't work in war. What works in war is achieving a result which is conclusive to guarantee that there isn't going to be a next war. The United States did not seek proportional responses to Pearl Harbor. It's not like the Japanese attacked us at Pearl Harbor, we bombed Yokohama Bay or Tokyo Bay and called it a day. Proportionality involved the Tokyo fire raid, the bombings of course, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, horrific casualties inflicted on the Japanese, of course, similarly with the Nazis and the fascists, in order to achieve victory. And I think proportionality is a concept, one of these sort of alluring ideas, has done more to perpetuate conflict than it has to end it.
What does the political landscape of Gaza look like with Hamas removed?
Well, that's a great question. And you can ask what it looks like or what an ideal scenario may be.
You've suggested a zone of shared interest.
Right. So Hamas has more than Israel as an enemy. Hamas has Egypt as an enemy because the Egyptian government regime, really, suppresses the Muslim Brotherhood, which had been briefly in power a little over a decade ago. Hamas has Saudi Arabia and most of the Sunni states as enemies because although Hamas is religiously a Sunni organization, it's increasingly aligned strategically and politically with Iran. So all of the states in the region that see Iran as a threat understand that Hamas, like Hezbollah, like the Houthis in Yemen, are fingers or arms of Iranian power. Hamas is obviously a terrorist organization as far as the United States is concerned. So Hamas not in power in Gaza is a very good thing. I might add one other point, which is Hamas is the adversary of Fatah, the ruling party of the Palestinians in the West Bank. Lots of people would like to see Hamas go. So can you imagine a post-Hamas Gaza in which the Palestinian Authority, not my cup of tea, but not certainly not Hamas, returns to a position of civilian authority? Some kind of Arab League force led by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia with help from partners like the United Arab Emirates, perhaps Egypt, puts in a kind of a peacekeeping police force to guarantee that the Strip does not become, once again, a zone of the export of terror. The United States and Europe, particularly Europe, pony up money for economic reconstruction. Israel starts to see opportunities to let more Palestinians come in on work visas. Just before this conflict, by the way, 17,000 Palestinians every day were going to work in Israel, and those remittances were crucial to the Gazan economy. So this idea that Gaza was this wholly blockaded open-air prison is simply you know, doesn't correspond with reality. And by the way, Gaza is beautiful. It has a long beach. You know, it's not a huge place, but neither is Singapore. There are lots of small places that can be successful places if they are not so terribly misgoverned. Just think, I mean, this is a point I've often thought of, which is that the money that Hamas spent on building rockets, on building tunnels under the border with Israel, that represented probably tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars that could be spent on schools, health, businesses, creating something like a genuinely future-looking, a more prosperous state. The principal despot, the principal oppressor of the Palestinian people in Gaza has been Hamas for 16 years, which won an election, then threw its opponents out of buildings, and then ruled despotically ever since.
The Wall Street Journal has reported that Iran helped plan Hamas's attack and gave it the green light. Hamas and Iranian officials are denying Iranian government involvement, yet they are celebrating in Tehran.
Not everywhere, by the way. There's footage from a soccer stadium in Tehran, which is usually a zone of protest. The Iranian people are sick and tired of being the funders of Palestinian militancy. But sorry for the interruption.
The pro-American Iranians are not celebrating. What is your assessment of Iran's involvement and motives?
I don't believe Iran for a second, the Iranian regime, I should say, for a second, in saying they had no hand in planning this. It was far too convenient for them. They've been funding and arming and helping Hamas in multiple ways now for many, many years. The idea that they would not have foreknowledge, that they wouldn't be involved, I think is implausible. I could be wrong, but it's highly unlikely. I think it is significant that the Iranians are furiously denying it, and significant because they may not feel like they're prepared to get into a war, either directly or from one of their other proxies with Israel right now. So my guess is they had a large hand in it, but I don't want to get ahead of the intelligence.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken and others have suggested Hamas's attacks were aimed to derail Israel's normalization with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. What is the future of those negotiations right now?
Look, the conventional wisdom is if Israel responds in a big way and
disproportionately
and inevitably and tragically, I need to understate that, tragically, there are a lot of Palestinian civilians caught in crossfire and killed, that it will put paid any hopes of a Saudi Israeli deal. I think that's false. Look.
Why?
Well, I'll tell you, because the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, even Sudan, did not sign the Abraham Accords with Israel because they suddenly woke up and thought, gosh, you know, the Jewish people are such exciting people and the state of Israel is this great startup nation. And we what have we been thinking? They looked to Israel because Israel to them seemed like the strong horse. The idea of the strong horse and the weak horse, somewhat cliched, but they are ideas about power, particularly in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, Israel appeared like it was a strong horse, particularly in leading a common front against Iran and its proxies. That was especially so in an era when American power and influence in the region appeared to be in retreat. So the Emiratis were looking around and asking themselves, well, if it's not going to be the Americans, if we can't quite rely on them, if America's kind of sick of the Middle East, who can we rely on? And they looked at Israel and they saw that Israel was allegedly assassinating Iranian scientists and taking out Iranian nuclear facilities and doing this, that, and the other, and putting the Iranians on the back foot. So they went with Israel because Israel seemed like a strong horse. If now you have a situation in which 1,200 Israelis or more are dead, and Israel still cannot displace a militia like Hamas from the Gaza Strip, it will create a real and I think justified impression that Israel is not, in fact, the strong horse. It's a weak horse. It's not going to be a good and strong and willful ally in the fight against Iranian encroachments. So again, I think it's important to differ to differentiate between what the Riyadh says, what the pronouncements they make, which are for public consumption, and the way they think strategically about the region.
So you have just suggested that the cautionary tale for Israel is responding too softly.
Right.
There is an argument that this was intended to provoke a very, very strong response, which would then undermine Israel on the world stage in some way.
Right. And I think in that sense, Hamas potentially miscalculated very badly. If Hamas's goal, or one of their goals, was to derail the prospect of a Saudi-Israeli deal, peace deal, by inviting massive Palestinian casualties. And by the way, just stop to consider the cynicism that Hamas thought it could profit first by killing Israelis and then by Israel killing Palestinians. But if that was indeed their calculation, and if Israel responds in a way that is unequivocal in destroying Hamas as an organization, I suspect they would have done more to advance the prospects of a Saudi-Israeli rapprochement than to destroy them.
So those who are concerned that this series of tragic attacks could compromise progress with the Abraham Accords and the normalization between Israel and several Arab nations, you think are misguided?
Yeah, no, I think that's what we're going to hear. And look, Israel should seek to minimize Palestinian casualties because that's what armies from civilized societies do, period, right? It is simply a moral imperative, and there's a concept in the Israeli military called the purity of arms, a real idea that force should be used morally. By the way, something that helps Israel too, because it creates a sense that Israel is a force for good, that they can hold their heads up high and they're not reducing themselves to the level of their enemies. But one way or another, Israel is going to have a big fight on its hands, and it had better achieve a decisive result. You know, Israelis can't achieve unconditional victory the way Ulysses Grant did, because that requires unconditional surrender, and they're never going to obtain that from their enemies. But they can achieve an unequivocal victory. That is to say, the kind of victory that leaves nobody in doubt as to who was the victor and who was the loser in the war. They did that in 73 after the initial setbacks. By the end of the war, Israel had encircled an entire army in the Sinai. Israeli tanks were 20 miles out of Damascus. There was no question who'd won the war. And it was on the basis of that win, of that victory, that 4 years later, 5 years later, they were able to achieve that historic peace with Egypt at Camp David.
Let me ask you about the Biden administration's posture.
And let there be no doubt, the United States has Israel's back. We'll make sure the Jewish and democratic state of Israel can defend itself today, tomorrow, as we always have.
You know, I'm a little reluctant to score the Biden administration at this moment because I think the president made an excellent statement. I am grateful that there is moral clarity in the White House. It is a resource that is in short supply in Washington these days. And I was glad to see him stand unequivocally with Israel and to condemn the barbarity. I criticize the Biden administration because I want it to do better, but I am rooting for its success. Sending an aircraft carrier to the Eastern Mediterranean is the right thing to do. Expediting 1,000 smart bombs for the Israeli Air Force is the right thing. The kind of statement the president made in the White House, lighting up the White House in blue and white, these are the right things to do. So at moments like this, I think we have to take a bit of a step back from kind of the nonstop criticism machine. You should have done it this way. You shouldn't have done it that way. Simply appreciate an administration that at least has its moral bearings and understands just how serious this is, not just for Israel, but for anyone who cares about terrorism and the threat it poses to their own people.
Take on this one. The left-leaning Israeli newspaper Haaretz said in an editorial that Netanyahu bears clear responsibility for the violence, and he cited his government's focus on expanding Israeli territory at the expense of Palestinian rights. What say you?
Look, as I said, I've been very critical of Netanyahu. The responsibility for the attack lies with Hamas. I mean, that it should be obvious, and it's but it needs to be stated clearly. On the other hand, what happened on Saturday, what Hamas did, isn't exactly an advertisement for a Palestinian state. If the suggestion is, well, if the Palestinians had a state, none of this would be happening. Maybe the response, and it's a plausible response, is, well, if the Palestinians had a state, and if it was controlled by Hamas, and if it included the West Bank as well as the Gaza Strip, then the horror that unfolded, that's unfolding this week, would be 10 times greater because Hamas might control that much more territory. You know, what's at issue here? I've been a supporter of a two-state solution, in theory, for a very long time. Israel did not come into existence in order to rule over other people in one form or another. Israel came into existence so that Jews could rule themselves, yeah. Right? That being said, it matters to Israel whether a Palestinian state resembles Costa Rica or whether it resembles Yemen. And unfortunately, under Hamas, it resembles Yemen. Hamas and its allies in Palestinian society have decided that they're more interested in Palestine being a base for the destruction of Israel than they are in Palestine being a state in which Palestinians can flourish. And that's what needs to change. So the idea that, oh, if Bibi had just helped create a Palestinian state by, you know, snapping his finger, this wouldn't have been happening, I think needs to be rethought given the nature of Palestinian politics. At root, the question is always, well, sure, a state, but what kind of state? I mean, it begs all the cliches about the devil being in the details. So we should support a Palestinian state that is moderate and modernizing. There are other examples in the region, UAE, Oman, and so on. There's no reason why a future Palestinian state can't follow those examples. But if they're intent on following the example of Hezbollah in Lebanon or the Houthis in Yemen, then a Palestinian state will have to wait because the alternative is the kind of mass murder we've witnessed this week.
Benjamin Netanyahu was a guest on the original Firing Line with William F. Buckley Jr. in 1986. He had just published a book entitled Terrorism, How the West Can Win.
Yeah.
And Buckley asks Netanyahu to define terrorism.
My definition of terrorism is the systematic and deliberate attack, the murder, maiming, and menacing of innocents, of civilians, for political goals.
Well, now, was under that definition terrorism committed in Israel between, say, 1945 and 1948?
Well, then on that basis, you can check anyone, including Israel, and it matters not the identity of the perpetrator or the cause that he professes, but whether that definition sticks. Now, there are basically two celebrated instances that are mentioned in this case. One is Deir Yassin, the other is King David. And neither one of those conditions, if you look at the historical fact, was the object of the attack civilians, nor was there systematic and deliberate attacks on them. I think that you can tell a lot about terrorists, but what happens when they come to power? Those who fight for freedom and come to power do not impose terrorism. Those who do, who fight in terroristic means, end up as being masters of terrorist states in Libya, in Algeria, and other countries that support and practice terrorism.
So those who fight with terroristic means end up masters of terrorist states. He describes Gaza.
Of course, yeah. And by the way, it describes so many other post-colonial states that came into existence from people who describe themselves as freedom fighters but use terroristic means and then ended up creating despotisms in their own societies. It's not unique to the Palestinians.
Your latest column is about the growing anti-Israeli left.
From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free.
You went to Times Square, Midtown Manhattan, to observe a pro-Palestinian rally. What'd you see?
I saw Euphoria. The rally was on Sunday, a day after the massacres. And there was one speaker who was jeering and laughing at the killing of the young people at the dance party, the rave. This wasn't people who I might disagree with saying, we want peace or we want a Palestinian state. This was people who were celebrating mass murder the way Argentina celebrated its victory in the World Cup. And if you don't see in this all the classic tropes of anti-Semitism, thinly disguised, very thinly disguised as anti-Zionism, I think you're just failing to see reality. Now, does this describe, do those protesters describe the majority of the American left? No, of course not. But I think they're more influential, and they are happening, an event like that happens because the environment culturally and intellectually and morally in which they emerged was conducive to that kind of thinking. When you mainstream anti-Zionism and think that it is okay to subscribe to an ideology which believes that one country and one country only should be destroyed, well, then it's not a far leap to then say, well, if you want to destroy it, look, there, that's exactly what Hamas is doing. If you say, as one placard holder had it, that Zionism equals genocide, well, then all means are justified to oppose Zionism, because after all, what is worse than genocide? There has been a kind of mainstreaming of the demonization of Israel, far in excess of the state's sins, real or alleged, that contributed to this atmosphere. And by the way, notice another thing. Notice
the atmosphere in the West, in terms of the West's response.
In terms of in the West, from Australia to London, New York, Toronto, these protests were taking place. And again, the people who were themselves at the protesters, I think, are a subset of a subset. Even Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez
denounced
it. I mean, she's thinking of her political future, and this was toxic even by her standards. But there's a shadow, an umbra, and a penumbra around that rally that is powerful in the left. And by the way, I yield to no one in the criticisms I've made of the Trumpian right, okay? So some viewers will say, well, you're just some Republican guy. A, I'm not a Republican. B, I criticize the right plenty. But the left needs to take a very hard look at itself, because they have normalized a level of demonization of Israel and a level of excuse-making for the Palestinians that creates moral conditions in which a protest like that can happen. These guys didn't just emerge from nowhere. What I witnessed in New York was every bit as repugnant and repulsive as what the world witnessed in Charlottesville, just on the other side. Both sides demonizing the Jews.
You wrote, I'm talking about university presidents who stand for free speech when it comes to anti-Semitism, but become notably censorious when it comes to other forms of controversial speech. Larry Summers, former president of Harvard University, observed a similar phenomenon in his alma mater or in his university this week. But this is not only on university campuses, as you point out. This is a, as you say, sort of a penumbra that is more broadly permeated our culture. Where is that coming from? Like, why the uptick?
Look, I think that you've had two generations of university students who've been educated in a certain world worldview, which is that if you are the perceived oppressed, you're always in the right. Sometimes you're in the right, sometimes you're not in the right, okay? But that the view was, you know, you are the perceived oppressed, so you must be right. If you attach the word anti-colonialist to your name, never mind that Zionism is one of the great forms of anti-colonialism in history. Zionists defeated the English to become and fought the English to become a state. That leads to this this kind of atmosphere. When you've decided that anti-Semitism is just this kind of microaggression in the scale of hatreds, then it's not surprising that university presidents who rightly didn't waste a second after the George Floyd murder mm-hmm. kind of take their time when you have this kind of mass atrocity in Israel. It's why so many Jewish students on campuses feel like they have to hide their Stars of David, feel like they have to be careful to whom they acknowledge their Jewishness, or they have to speak less in classes when the subject of the state of Israel comes up, because it gets uncomfortable for them. So an atmosphere has been created, and you can talk to anyone who's now sending a child to an elite university or even a not so elite university, you know, and they will confirm that this is happening. So we have to think not only about the visible evidences of anti-Semitism, we have to think about all of the current cultural fashions and prejudices that contribute to an atmosphere in which anti-Semitism can flourish. You know, just as it's not enough to say, well, we have to get rid of Jim Crow laws and all of the formal structures of white supremacy and racism that existed in America up until relatively recently. We have to do the cultural work as well, right? We have to do that also with anti-Semitism. And just, you know, 2 points in this respect. Anti-Semitism is not just a bigotry. It's a conspiracy theory. It's a conspiracy theory about Jews. So in a country in which conspiracy theories flourish about all kinds of things, ultimately they're going to flourish about anti-Semitism will be one of those conspiracy theories. There are, when you say that, you know, when the entire structure of university education is to teach you about the virtues of anti-colonialism what used to be called tiers-mondialisme, right? And then you think, wow, gee, it's sort of surprising that all of a sudden Jewish students don't feel welcome on college campuses. This didn't happen in a vacuum, is the point I'm trying to make. And university presidents and administrators and deans who have duties in this respect, these are words that don't come naturally to me. They need to educate themselves. Just as they have educated themselves about racism and homophobia, they need to educate themselves in a deep way about anti-Semitism, because the genie that has been unleashed is a dangerous one, and it is out there.
As you know, for decades there have been deep disagreements amongst Israeli citizens mm-hmm. about the question of Palestinian autonomy. How do these attacks impact those debates?
Look, I think the average Israeli would say, if you were to tell him or her, well, now is a good time to move to a Palestinian state, the typical Israeli would say, just look. And so Hamas has set the cause back of a Palestinian state by generations. But Israelis are, you know, they understand. I know few Israelis who, if told, I have knowledge from the future, that if you usher in or help usher into existence a Palestinian state now, that it will live in peace with Israel, that it will be a neighbor to you the way Canada is a neighbor to the United States. There are very few Israelis who would say, no, I'd rather have the land. I'd rather have the conflict. I'd rather have the heartbreak. Maybe there's some, but not many. So anyone who spends time in Israel understands how profound the yearning for peace is. And that yearning will be fulfilled when a generation of Palestinians comes of age and says to themselves, what Hamas has bequeathed us, we don't want. That's when this conflict will finally come to an end.
Brett Stevens, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.